Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're here on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Birmingham and Coventry National Union of Journalists branch officer Chris Hewitt. He's a freelance writer, railway buff and technology journalist. But we speak to him this week about Operation Market Garden, that's the Bridge Too Far film portrayed in the Second World War, the raid, the attempt to liberate Holland in September 1944, all the way to Brexit. And then Stroud activist Richard House. He's a writer on education and on social justice. Nice to hear from Stroud, a hotbed of activism, not so far from Bristol. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. What about the Market Garden battle, though, the Bridge Too Far? There were two main bridges that they were going for, which was at Nijmegen and Arnhem. How come they never made it?
I think it was a breakdown in communications. The fact that the relief column, being organised by General Horrocks, they were told to stop in the middle of nowhere, and nobody's ever had a satisfactory reason. The tank commanders actually said, we can't go forward because we haven't got any supporting infantry, which means, of course, that we'll be cut down by any German anti-tank weapons. There's also things like the boats for the Americans to row across to the other side. I mean, they were in the wrong place. You know, that's where you see Robert Redford, paddling away with his rifle butt. I think if the planning had been better, it would have been a success. We shouldn't underestimate it. It was 90% successful. It certainly gave the German commanders on the ground a very unpleasant surprise when they realised the effort we prepared to put in with it. But actually, going around the Siegfried Line, I mean, that was actually militarily correct because all the equipment had been stripped out of that and sent to the Eastern Front. You know, it was just a few old-age pensioners guarding it.
What about the commitment of the Allies to actually fight to Berlin? Because the Russians said, actually, you're not really fighting as hard as us. And there is some evidence for that, isn't there?
That's because Stalin was prepared to take any casualties to get to Berlin for May the 1st. I mean, Zhukov was ordered to take Berlin by the 1st of May, no matter what he had to do to get there. And I think there was a deal done that the Red Army would be allowed to capture Berlin, in view of their much higher casualties. But it certainly wasn't true that lack of commitment from Britain, because we and the Americans were supplying a lot of equipment to the Red Army. I mean, for example, the old Standard Triumph factory in Coventry, there was a production line that did nothing but make tanks, Russian tanks.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, not 234s. It was the light support. It was their infantry support tank, which was a cut down version of the Churchill. But I mean, certainly, if you see pictures of the Eastern Front, which is obviously there are plenty of it. If you see a tank that looks like a Churchill with lots of little small wheels, those are made at Standard Triumph. There was actually a propaganda film of Royal Engineer soldiers and car workers putting one of these tanks together and sort of, gift to Stalingrad from the cop workers of Coventry.
Now, Joseph Goebbels, at the beginning of the war, said, well, it's a toss of the coin whether to be a fascist or a communist. They're both different sides of the same coin.
The sort of people who were at the top of both regimes are very similar personalities. I mean, don't also forget, of course, guess who was secretary of the Munich Commune just after the First World War? Hitler. He had a very good grounding of how the communist side worked. But in terms of personality, you often do find much the same sort of people on the far left as you do on the far right.
What about after the war, the deals done with the Allies? Because we even had Winston Churchill threatening to nuke Moscow, even though he wasn't Prime Minister anymore, and they had to keep him off the BBC because he kept talking about how it was so necessary to attack the Russians. It does imply that maybe there was rather more support for Nazi Germany and Britain than was recognised during the war.
Certainly amongst the British establishment, though, what you're quite right, the French military commander of Kent regularly complained that he was not allowed to intern the Nazi sympathisers who openly went around saying that, we'd rather do a business with Adolf than Stalin. He's only the big fish of the British Nazis who got interned. There's far more people. If you get what's called the White Book, which is what the Germans were going to use to run this country, assuming they'd won, you'll actually see that it gives a list of all the people they wanted to get rid of immediately. They immediately want to get rid of most trade union officials, people like Bernard Russell and H.G. Wells. They'd be shot immediately. you can clearly see where they're going on, and they would want to make friends with the British establishment to get them to do their dirty work for them. And they, of course, were quite right that a lot of the British establishment were very right-wing, in fact, still are very right-wing.
What about the one aspect of this that many people maybe cynically say is, well, the Japanese and the Germans industrially have done incredibly well after the Second World War. Maybe they lost militarily, but they won economically.
Well, they won economically because of martial aid. The one thing the Americans did get right, in fact, this is something that Roosevelt agreed with Churchill, was that if there is mass unemployment in Germany, we'll be able to fight the far right again in 25 years. I mean, that's why massive martial aid was put in, to get the German economy going and get people off the dole, so they weren't listening to the far left and the far right. The Japanese were blessed with the war in Korea, because they'd obviously got all these factories which were fully equipped. I mean, the Japanese did much better at getting their industry up to date than you're quite right, they're given credit for. But as soon as the Korean War started, all the big Japanese factories went back in to producing equipment for the United Nations forces in Korea.
Industry seems to have moved mainly to Germany.
No, it hasn't moved to Germany. Jaguars, Land Rovers are still made in this country.
Aren't they about to move? That's one of the things I've heard, that they could be about to move. And anyway, the decisions about where those factories are not made in the UK anymore.
No, those sort of decisions always have been made by boards of directors.
But Jaguar and Land Rover were both British boards of directors. I mean, you can't expect a company that isn't British to be looking out for the British worker and the British interests.
Well, if they move to Slovakia, which incidentally has little or no manufacturing tradition, they would, of course, qualify for whopping great European loans. I mean, it's a lot more to do. It's the management consultants who are the real villains of the piece. By the way, the EC was set up at the behest of Churchill to make sure to interlock the economies of France, Germany and Italy so they could never go to war against each other again. It was never intended that we were going to join. If we wanted to join, we would have gone in on day one.
So what do you make of Brexit, Chris? Is it going to be a total disaster, or are there positive sides to it?
I think the Tory Brexiteers have thought it out very carefully. Hard Brexit is just not deliverable. I mean, I voted to leave. I voted against joining the EU, and I voted for Brexit. But hard Brexit is just not deliverable. And they're going to find that out the hard way. And it could well cost the present government a lot of many years in opposition.
Well, why not? Why isn't it deliverable?
Because effectively you're unscrambling eggs. It's a lot more difficult. It's not just a case of going to the World Trade Organization, because those agreements are nowhere near perfect. I also, a lot of Brexit is a bit of opportunism by Boris Johnson, because he thinks this is the quickest way to get the keys to number 10. Though I think that the truth is that he'll be getting the keys to the leader of the opposition's office, unless he can pull a PR miracle out of the hat within the next 6 months. But said it's a lot more complex. You've got to disengage from a lot of agreements. Also, Boris and people like that do not understand the real reason why many people voted to leave. It wasn't because they're against the principle of a EU. What they're against is political and monetary union. As I said at the time, that the question on the paper was wrong. What they should have said is, do you want to belong to the EU if it's just a free trade area? I'd have no problem voting yes for that. Do you want political union or do you want monetary union? I think most, now if it had been anything like that, we'd still be in, but the government would be given a clear mandate just to get rid of political and monetary union. I might add that in the previous, in the original referendum, the Roy Jenkins and his crew actually denied that political and monetary union was going to take place. In fact, if you could get the black and white film out, you look at the films taken of Tony Benn and Clive Jenkins, then comparing what Roy Jenkins and Shirley Williams said, Tony and Clive, you know, were 90% correct in what they predicted would happen. And I also must point out that before Germany went into the EU, its economy was actually growing at a faster rate.
Chris, how do we follow your work online? Where can we find some of your stuff on technology?
It's on the world. If you put my name into Google, you will find a lot of articles about technology. They'll be published all over the world. In fact, I even looked at once, and I think the Jamaican Gleaner, which is their national paper, even got a couple of my articles in it. Although, of course, it'd be nice to be paid for them.
Chris, can you just spell your name for us as well? Because it's your surname particularly is a little bit awkward to spell.
It's Anglo-Saxon. It's Youett.
Chris Youett, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Richard House. I live in People's Alternative Republic of Stroud, which is what we Stroudies tend to call Stroud. I've been here for over 4 years now, and I'm in the Labour Party. I joined the Labour Party because of Jeremy Corbyn, like hundreds of thousands of Labour Party members have done. And I've been involved in various political initiatives in Stroud for the last 4 years, one of them being the Politics Kitchen, which is a store we have on the High Street every Friday and Saturday, where we invite people to come and have non-partisan political conversations, where we try to listen to people rather than preach, and trying to kind of find a new paradigm for politics, because the existing political system is absolutely broken. And I think lots of us see it that way.
Stroud's got an interesting heritage in that it was a key place actually in the Industrial Revolution. And one of the things I'm surprised about is quite a lot of people who live in Stroud are aware of this history, aware of the history around them. I think they've only got one cloth mill left, doing really high-end felt for tennis balls for Wimbledon and snooker tables and things like that. But it was, I mean, can you just tell us about that, a bit about that history and why it happened here?
I'm afraid I can't, Tony. I'm not a historian. I'm not a local historian, certainly. I know someone who you could talk to about that, who's on the council, who's into local history.
Go on, who's that?
But Chas Townley, who is a Labour.
Okay, well, let
me just say something. But I do believe, and you might think this is a bit kind of new age mumbo jumbo, I do believe that places hold a history. And that we're deeply impacted by that, not at a conscious level. Now, this is a psychotherapist, because I used to be a psychotherapist, so this is a bit of therapy speak. But I do believe that, and so it wouldn't surprise me at all if myself, with lots of other people, have been deeply influenced by the history of this place, even though we're not kind of conscious of it. Now, you might think that's mumbo jumbo, but I think there's something in that.
Also, the town had a green mayor for many years, John Marjoram, as well. So it's not your average sort of dichotomy between Tory Labour here.
Absolutely not. It's an extraordinary place. If you look at the results of the general election in 2017, there's one tiny blue dot in the whole of the this part of England, and that's Stroud Labour by 673
votes. Red.
Yeah, sorry. What did I say? Oh, that's a real. That's not a Freudian mistake.
Can you just say that again?
Yeah. Yes. There's only one red dot right in the middle of a sea of blue around this part of England, Cotswolds, you know, sort of mid West England, and we won the seat here by 673 votes. So we've got a Labour Member of Parliament right in the centre of the Cotswolds, which is extraordinary. This is a really radical place, and there's loads of Labour supporters, loads of Green supporters, and in the town itself, in the general election campaign last year, I didn't see one Conservative poster anywhere. You had to go out into the surrounding rural areas to start seeing
the landowners.
Yeah. So Stroud is a cauldron of radical left, green, spiritual activism, and it's an amazing place to be.
What about your own campaign here with the sub rooms? Because this was it's the subscription rooms. It's the place where it is the main, I suppose, civic building that most people and visitors will see in the town centre here in Stroud. And as a lot of other buildings in the town, it's getting a bit run down, a lot of empty shops, that sort of thing. So just tell us that story. What's happened with that building?
Well, it's quite a long story. I'll try and be succinct. Last year, the district council made it known that they wanted to sell off the subrooms, because it was actually technically and legally owned by Stroud District Council, and it had been making a loss. They claimed, I'll come to that in a minute, they claimed it was making a loss of £450,000 per annum, and on the basis of that they put it out to tender. We discovered through various routes that in fact there had been conversations some years earlier between a local company called Ecotricity, some of your listeners might have heard of, and the owner Dale Vince, who really wanted the subrooms. And so it seemed pretty clear that there was a kind of carefully hatched plan to drive through the selling off of the subrooms to Ecotricity.
Well, Ecotricity is a pretty good cause, isn't it? I mean, what's the problem?
Ecotricity is a private company. The things that we've heard on the high street on our store, which I can't repeat here, don't inspire a lot of confidence if that sale had actually happened. And it's about the principle of community public assets being sold off to the private sector. On principle, the people here rose up in their thousands and said, no, we're not going to have it. And that's the way we stopped it happening. And we've been told by someone very high up in the Labour Party that it was a miracle that our campaign here stopped that selling off, because she said that it was a shoo-in. They'd already decided it. The officers had decided it. Everything had been lined up, and she said it was extraordinary that our campaign managed to stop that. So it just shows that when people get on the street and they start making a big noise, you can actually change things. And that's important today, because a lot of people feel helpless in this system that we're in.
So what do you actually do? I mean, you're talking about going on the street. What, did you stand there waving a banner or what?
Well, literally the same day as we heard about this, I immediately made some leaflets. I got the for sale sign for the subrooms blown up in the local James and Owen, and then we scrawled over it, no sale, in great big red and green felt tip. We made huge boards out of it, and then we just went straight down to the high street and we set up a store. And we had our store, and we were there for about 2 months. That, not quite every day. If it was raining or it was snowing, we didn't. But apart from that, we were there every day.
You're saying we? You and whose army?
Well, myself and my Politics Kitchen colleagues, Terry Kevins, he was on there virtually every day. So was I. Dave Lambert, Skeena Rathor. We kind of took it in turns, and the response we had was extraordinary. People were queuing up to help, to sign our petition. Within about a month, we'd gathered about 4,500 people had signed our petition. Stroud's got a population of about 12,900, so like one in three of the people of Stroud had signed our petition like within a few weeks. So that was just a sign. That just shows if you can pitch the message right, people will rise up. And it soon became clear to the Labour controlled district council that if they were to drive this through, the amount of anger, the amount of rage, and the cost they'd have paid at the polls would have been huge. So they realised they had to reverse it and turn.
Talking about rising up, it wasn't pitchforks. How did it actually happen? I mean, it was just literally being able to make it clear to the councillors that they probably would just lose their seats and lose their jobs.
Yeah, we had all sorts of things. I've got a postcard here, that, which we had hundreds of these made. It's got a beautiful picture of the subrooms. It says, not for sale. And on the back, it says, Dear Councillor Lydon, we appeal to Stroud District Council to ensure that the subscription rooms and its forecourt area remain in community ownership. It is a vital community asset. And then people wrote their name and address, and then they wrote their reasons on it. And they had hundreds of these were actually sent to the council. So this is just one example of the various things we do. We're urging people to actually kind of to find out who their councillor was, and then to write to them. So they were inundated. So this was real kind of grassroots sort of community action. Yeah.
Now, aren't you in danger of alienating quite an important local employer by doing this? And also, I mean, this is surely just a natural process. So many of our public assets are now are being sold off, and that money raised can be used to improve local services.
Well, that's a kind of, it's quite a complicated argument, that. I mean, firstly, it's just a one-off, and so yes, it would have brought in, I think they were going to sell it for £200,000, which, if you've seen the building, is like exactly, it just leaves one breathless. But you know, so they'd have got £200,000, that would have been a short-term bung to some public services. But then the problem is with this, Tony, that actually by doing that you're colluding with the neoliberal agenda. You're colluding with a world in which the way that we're going to fund public services is either to flog off all the public assets we can, or we're just going to kind of shut them down. Now, some of us, certainly within the Labour Party, actually, we're not going to put up with that. We're fed up with it. And I know that Bristol is full of very, very radical activists, kind of people on the left as well. And there are people all over the country who aren't going to put up with neoliberalism anymore. It's a failed model. It's been going for 40 years.
We keep hearing about neoliberalism. Can you explain what neoliberalism is?
Neoliberalism is an approach to the market economy that was brought in from about the mid-1970s onwards, inspired by people like Milton Friedman and Hayek, taken up by Sir Keith Joseph, who was a mentor of Margaret Thatcher. And Thatcher got in 79. Reagan was in at the same time. And from then onwards, we've been subjected to free market policies, which are determined to privatise as many of the public services as it's possible to do, and so that the whole of society is subject to market relations. We think that's catastrophic. Of course, there's a place for the market and for private enterprise within a kind of mixed society. But these people who are often called neoliberals, they want to privatise everything. if they could have got away with it, they would have actually privatised the schooling system and the National Health Service. They know they can't get away with that politically, so they're doing it behind, sort of in a very surreptitious way, you know, in kind of small bits and pieces. But that is the overall logic of what's happening. And it's been going on for 40 years. And what is so hopeful about Jeremy Corbyn is he's the first political leader who stood up and said no and is challenging that.
Well, so did Owen Smith, didn't he? He said the same, pretty much, in the leadership challenge.
I think Owen Smith was saying whatever he thought he needed to say in order to try and beat Jeremy in the leadership contest. And everybody could see through it. The thing about Jeremy Corbyn is you get authenticity. People believe in him. My daughter is 20. She's 21 on Thursday. She went to see Jeremy in Norwich a couple of years ago, and she came out and she said, "That's the first political leader I've ever seen that I really believe what he is saying, and he's being honest, he's being truthful, and this is why young people in their thousands are singing, oh, Jeremy Corbyn all over the country, because they've discovered a politician they can trust." Yeah.
What about the press? Because that's obviously a major factor in any democracy. What about the press here in Stroud? You've got, I think, Stroud Life and Stroud News and Journal, the two main outlets. I imagine you read them reasonably vociferously. I know you have quite a lot of letters in them. What do you make of them?
Well, first, just to say that Stroud Life closed about a year ago. And the Gloucester Citizen was a daily, but that also closed and went to a weekly. It's now called the Stroud Citizen. So we've got two local weekly papers, the Stroud Citizen and the Stroud News and Journal. Also got the Western Daily Press, which is also down your way, which is expanded into Gloucestershire. I am a kind of compulsive writer of letters to newspapers, as you've just referred to, and they publish most of the stuff that I actually send in, and it's all pretty sort of Corbynista stuff. It's the kind of stuff, if you sent it into the Telegraph or the Mail or the Sun, you wouldn't have a sort of snowball's chance in hell of it getting in. But in the local press, they are prepared to listen to a whole kind of range of political voices. Having said that, just recently, the Stroud News and Journal, the last 3 weeks, has gone very quiet on its letters page. There's been hardly anything kind of controversial. And I'm just starting to panic and thinking, oh, they've kind of changed their kind of line on local politics. But certainly until recently, you would get a whole range of sort of political viewpoints on there. And I think that's what's great about about local newspapers, because they see that it's important to represent a sort of range of views, whereas the kind of national press tends to be very, very sort of polarised and very sort of biased towards the right. And so the sort of political left doesn't really get a fair hearing, whereas I think in the sort of local newspapers, we do get a much fairer hearing, actually. Yeah.
Well, you don't just do the letters to the press, do you? You've also done quite a bit of writing, essays and things like that, and even chapters. Can you tell us about some of that? Are your interests in that writing?
Yes. I mean, my kind of professional background is a psychotherapist and counsellor, and in the education field, I've been a campaigner in sort of the early years for about 15 or 20 years now. So I kind of write on in the education field. I've got columns in kind of magazines and stuff that come out regularly. And
tell us about some of those. Where can we read you?
Well, you can read my Critical Corner column in Teach Early Years magazine that comes out six times a year. So each issue I've got a page which is called Critical Corner, where I write something that's quite kind of controversial about the early years, because I did campaign over about 6 years, challenging the Early Years Foundation stage, which came in 2008, and we see us having all kinds of problems. So I was a major sort of campaigner against that. So I'm a bit of a campaigner, I suppose you could say. I kind of enjoy challenging things in society that I just think are wrong, and politicians kind of get, and policy makers, they just get things wrong so often that that they need people like us to be challenging them all the time, you know.
The younger years in schooling has changed a lot over the last 20 years, and probably even more over the last 10 years. Lots of emphasis now on trying to get the very youngest children doing actually quite complicated learning rather than play.
Yeah. It's absolutely catastrophic. It's absolutely catastrophic. This is why I was involved in the campaign I mentioned just now. The problem we've got is that politicians don't understand, and they don't want to, they actually don't want to understand that particularly with young children, the way that you are with them, the way that you work with them must be developed, must fit their stage of development. It's a major mistake to be trying to get young children to do things before they are capable of actually doing them, because you're setting them up to fail. You're setting them up to feel sort of, you know, failures themselves, which for a young child to end up feeling that it somehow isn't kind of competent at something is absolutely catastrophic, because it, because, you know, all therapists you'd speak to, it stays with you for life. You know, those things at very young age, they actually go very, very deep, and they're very hard to change. And I can and so what's happening is that those kind of practices, which I'm afraid the Early Years Foundation stage has got a lot to answer for, they actually displace free play. Young children up to the age of 5 or 6 need to be moving and using their bodies and playing, and not kind of directed play, so that they kind of learn the outcomes that the adults have decided they should be learning. They should be freely playing themselves. If you watch young children playing freely, they are incredible. You know, they're creative. They're, you know, they make up amazing kind of stories. They're wonderfully rich. And but if you bring in sort of quasi-formal learning, which is what's happening with phonics being pushed onto 3- and 4-year-olds, That joy of learning, the danger is you lose it for life. And so this is one of the things I've been campaigning on this actually since about 1999, since so nearly 20 years, and things continue to get worse.
Quite a lot of people in the education industry, because it's becoming an industry, really say that play is a waste of time.
Well, they honestly don't know what they're talking about. If you listen to people like Albert Einstein, is a really good example. He was asked, "How can I make my young child intelligent?" His answer was, "Tell them fairy tales." Then he was asked, "But how can I make them more intelligent?" And he said, "Tell them more fairy tales." Play is the way that young children learn about the world, about themselves. It's the way they process things and make sense of things, not in some rational, conscious way, because, you know, young children are not mini grown-ups. This is the great mistake that politicians make. They treat young children as if they're mini grown-ups. They're not. They've got their own kind of being, way of being, their own kind of consciousness, and the kind of task that we've got is to tune into that and to really understand it deeply, and then provide settings where children can develop in a way that is kind of developmentally right for them. Of course, when they're kind of six or kind of seven or eight, then you start to bring in, you know, literacy learning and numeracy learning, of course, fine. But not when they're three and four. It's too young for them.
What is phonics for people that aren't familiar with it, and what do you think's wrong with it?
Phonics is a way of teaching children to read. Which in my view is a very, very mechanistic approach. It's a very kind of narrow approach where you're just simply getting children to kind of recite letters, etc., etc., so that so that they get sort of deeply ingrained in them, and then the theory is that then helps them then to then kind of to be able to sort of read and write properly. The great danger of that is that, well, I'm just repeating myself, but actually you're trying to get children to do things before they're developmentally ready to actually do it. I mean, something that I haven't mentioned here. We've got in England, we've got a school starting age of effectively four. 90% of the world's countries have got a school starting age of six or seven. So our children start school at a ridiculously young age. Now, if in the first sort of couple of years, what they were doing was actually sort of developmentally fitted their age, then perhaps that could be made to be okay. But it's not. It's not actually okay when they're starting schooling at 4 years of age. And you hear all kinds of stories from my friends and people I know who said, you know, before their child started going to school, they were a happy and creative and joyful child. Now they're going to school, they traipse to school, they're not happy to be kind of going, they look pale. And this is because what they're being exposed to is not appropriate for their age.
What about alternatives to the state system?
Well, how long have we got? I'm a Steiner trained teacher and kindergarten teacher, so obviously that's the approach that I kind of know best. And in the Steiner system, and Bristol has got a couple of fantastic schools. The academy here, I think, opened about 3 or 4 years ago. You've now got a Steiner school here where people can go to a Steiner school without having to pay fees, which is, there's only four of those in the whole country, so Bristol's lucky to have one. And in that system, it's very much what I've just been saying. Children do not start formal learning until they go into school proper at about the age of six and a half. So, and that's what happens on the continent in lots of countries, in Finland and Scandinavia. But for some reason in England, and this was because of some perverse thing that happened in the 1871 Act, the Education Act of 1871. I won't go into it, but it's an extraordinary story. We're somehow kind of burdened with this incredibly kind of early school starting age, and you just got to go into a Steiner system and just to see how the children are. You go into a Steiner kindergarten and you see the 5-year-olds and the 6-year-olds playing with the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds, and you see, that's when you'll see how children are. They've created the environment which is absolutely developmentally right for them, and they absolutely thrive. Their kind of speech develops really well. They're outside playing and kind of climbing trees and doing all the things that young children should be doing to kind of challenge themselves. They're not sitting behind desks.
Some people have linked Rudolf Steiner and the anthroposophy that he's his kind of philosophy to Hitler and the Nazis.
Yeah. Well, as I think you know, I've written quite a lot about this, and there's a lot of literature that's very carefully shown that there's no truth whatsoever in the claim that Steiner's philosophy is racist, or it's just not true. And it also completely kind of ignores the historical sort of context of Steiner's work, which is actually 100 to 130 years ago. And, you know, society 100, 120 years ago was kind of very, very different to the society that we have today. And it's completely unfair to judge the things that someone might have written and said like 100, 120 years ago by the standards that we actually have today. But that's the move that these critics and there certainly are some out there, that's the move that these sort of critics make. And what I often say is, if you, this would be talking to one of the critics, if you had been someone who today had in your life given 6,500 lectures, and then in a century's time, someone in a 100 years' time was poring over every word that you said in those 6,500 lectures, don't you think that they might find the odd thing that was a little bit kind of tricky or sort of difficult within whatever the kind of current sort of morality will be in 100 years' time? But this is what Steiner's work is often being exposed to by people who, for whatever kind of nefarious reasons, want to sort of do him down and want to criticise his work. It's partly because he's got a spiritual worldview, and we live in a very materialistic world where there are lots of people who are very suspicious of things that are spiritual, and so they want to find whatever way they can to actually do it down.
What about learning for older children? There was a big change, really, after the Second World War, during the Second World War, in fact, with the Butler Act in Britain. Yeah. And grammar schools. And this is something that I always find a bit puzzling about the Labour Party. The object of that was to take bright, poor young children and give them a really top-notch education in grammar schools. And yet the Labour Party seems completely opposed to this. So what do you make of that?
Well, I have to declare an interest here, because I actually went to one of these grammar schools from a very, very, very poor rural Somerset working class background. I was in Sexes Bruton, some of you might have heard of, from 1965 to 1972, and then I got a place at university. I went to Exeter College, Oxford, and got a first class degree. So you, geography. So you could say that I'm actually one of these people that benefited from that. The problem is that if you just, well, there's all sorts of problems with it actually, but if you just cream off a kind of small a proportion of working class children who just happen to be fortunate to be bright, you're just kind of, well, first of all, you're just kind of paying lip service to sort of social mobility. I mean, let me tell you a story. I've got a friend who, this is an old school friend, who at school at the same time as him. He, when he took the 11 plus in 19, that would have been, let me just work it out, 53, about 1963, 64, he failed it. He, therefore, was siphoned off into the local secondary modern, Wincanton, that's the school that he went to. And it took him years to actually get over that. He finally got into Sexes in the sixth form, and he finally began to sort of find his level. But within that system, he was there was a decision made at sort of 10 years of age that he wasn't good enough to get this superior education, so he was just put off into a sort of second rate school. And so, and that's what that used to happen to the majority of working class children. They were just, you know, being prepared for, you know, jobs in, you know, factories and the kind of lowest possible sort of jobs in society. And of course, that suits the system. It suits the system to have just a few people from working class that can kind of, you know, get into the, you know, into the kind of university system and like be successful, because then the politicians can pretend that we've got a system of sort of social mobility, but actually it's just paying lip service to it. The vast majority still suffer. If we've got a, let's say, if we want to get beyond a kind of class society, what we've got to stop doing is creaming off a small number of privileged children and giving them and putting them into schools where they're quite separate from the rest of society. They're not, you know, meeting children from working class societies, etc., etc.
I mean, what the critics of, actually, I would say, is that, look, you've got a comprehensive system now. Which isn't, they don't really call them comprehensive schools. There are far, far less grammar schools around. What they do is they hold back the brightest pupils.
There's no reason in principle why bright pupils needn't be held back. All you need is teachers who've got the sort of creativity to know how to work with them, to have smaller class sizes. You need investment into the schooling system. Over the last 7 years, funding to the schooling system has been cut. Class sizes are going up and up and up. Teachers have got an absolutely impossible job. Lots of the time, they're just trying to manage behaviour, let alone getting children to actually learn things. We've got to fundamentally rethink the whole of the schooling system. It's that the whole system is hanging together by a thread. Everybody knows it. If you talk to, teachers, if you get them in private, they're all saying the same thing. And this is one of the hopes we got of, you know, Corbyn. When we get a really decent progressive Labour government, then it can start to really make some fundamental changes to the system. You can be sure that if the Conservatives get in again next time, which, you know, God help us if they do, we will just get more of the same. We'll get more of the same. There'll be more moves towards privatisation, because let's be clear, the whole, you know, the free school system, you know, the academies, it's preparing the ground to privatise the schooling system. That's what the Tories, that's what they want to do. And if they get in next time, that's what they will do.
Now, we've heard quite a bit about Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. His right-hand man is John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor. Yeah. There is an opportunity, if they do take power, to make some pretty fundamental changes. And if you were in his shoes, I know you're fairly familiar with his ideas. What are the main, should the main priorities be?
Investment in a sort of public sort of banking system.
See, a lot of people have talked about banking as a utility, saying it's a bit like your water supply and things like that, you know, which is, very rarely hear that said.
Well, there is certainly an argument about that, that public goods should be in the public sector. Now, and we're not talking about old style nationalisation. This is what the political right always come out with. They say, oh, we'll go back to the 1970s when the country was run by the trade unions, blah, 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 blah. Let's have public services that are democratically run, where those people that work in them have got a vested interest in making them work really, really well, who feel that they've got a real commitment to public service. Thankfully, we still have got quite a lot of people who are working in public services because they have that commitment to public service. They actually believe in it. The Tories hate public service. They don't want anything to do with people who feel they just want to, you know, individualise everything. Let's individualise things. Let's not have anything called community or solidarity. Let's just have...
I mean, that's an exaggeration, isn't it? I mean, they've just given a pay award, 3% pay award, to teachers and hospital workers, public sector pay award. They're saying, actually, these are really important people. We need to invest in them.
Well, that's after these people have had a real cut over the last 10 years of between 15 and 20%. So it's just peanuts. And also, they, you know, the Conservatives, they're not stupid. They know that they could only push their kind of scorched earth policy so far. And at some point, they have to at least be seen to have some sort of heart, because at the moment they're seen as being the nasty party in huge black capitals without any redeeming features at all. And I think that even sort of Theresa May realises that they've at least got to try to create the impression that they're not quite as hard. So you know, and they're also positioning themselves for the next general election. They, you know, they want to be able to say kind of, you know, warm and fuzzy things during the next election campaign. So there's a lot of positioning going on at the moment. But you just got to look at the actual figures that people that work in the public services have had their real wages and salaries cut by between 10 and 20% since the Conservatives got in 2010.
Well, we'll finish on the biggie, which is housing. There's a massive housing bubble being pumped up. A lot of people are foreign investors buying up British houses, particularly in London, Manchester, places like that. And the actual cost of building a house bears no relevance whatsoever to the cost of buying it. And this is massively important for a lot of young people who are looking to buy homes. Any thoughts about what's going on now to sort that one?
Well, again, I'm not really the person to ask this because this isn't my kind of area of expertise. But again, just a couple of broad brush things. The housing market is an absolute disaster, and some political party has got to grasp the nettle and do some really radical things. The things that are on top here, there has to be some kind of land tax. There has to be a massive public sector building program so that the price of houses starts to fall. I know there'll be a lot of homeowners, possibly even kind of Labour voting ones, who will find that a bit uncomfortable. But someone's got to grasp it, because for the last 20 or 30 years, all governments, and I'm talking about Labour governments, New Labour and Conservative, they have all had a policy of keeping the private housing market stoked up, because they see that there are votes in that. And as long as the housing market keeps, you know, going up, there's going to be a lot of people who are making a lot of money who are going to support the existing system. That is not sustainable in the long run, and it never was. And the great hope we have of a Corbyn government is that they will have the radicalism to really grasp this, because if and when they do get in, they will have a mandate to do radical things. And radical things need to happen, and there are always going to be winners and there are going to be losers. And I would suggest that in this system, the losers need to be private property owners who've seen the value of their properties go through the roof over the last 30 or 40 years, and the gainers have to be people in private rented accommodation and younger people who are looking to actually buy a house or to get a house that they can afford, which at the moment just isn't there. And we've got to grasp the nettle, and we have to change policies such that we have a housing system for the many, not for the few, because at the moment it's for the few.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Birmingham and Coventry National Union of Journalists branch officer Chris Hewitt and Stroud activist Richard House. Also to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain if you have the time, via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till the same time next week, here on Dialect, goodbye for now. Just love the greater.